Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Is the world more peaceful since the revolution? It is a shame that your people suffered. But bounty hunting is a complicated profession.
Hello and welcome back to Still Watching The Mandalorian. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I am a fellow writer at Vanity Fair, Anthony Bresnikan.
We are here to talk about Chapter 3 of The Mandalorian, subtitled The Sin.
The Sin. Very, very Roman Catholic, I think. As a boy who went to 12 years of Catholic school, I was like, ooh, The Sin, this sounds heavy.
we can talk at the end what we think the titular sin is. But we're going to talk about the episode. We're going to run down the episode. We're going to read an email that we got from you guys. If you are listening to this podcast, you can email us, stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. Any questions, comments, or corrections or concerns you have about our discussion.
Also theories. Let's hear some theories about what's coming next. I'd like to hear.
Yeah. Cause we don't know. Expect.
Yeah.
That's the point. Like, we are up to the number of episodes that Anthony and I have seen. We will not be spoiling it. We've never been spoiling anything in the future, but we will not be spoiling anything beyond episode 3. If you hear us talk about anything, it's just our speculation because we genuinely don't know. They've been keeping this pretty closely guarded. So, yeah. We're all in the same boat going forward. If you stick around to the end of this episode, you will hear Anthony's interview with the actress Emily Swallow, who voices the armorer, who obviously has a big, role to play in this episode.
Yeah. And, you know, does she voice it? Does she also play it? I'm really interested in that. Like, what her performance is like. We know Pedro is playing the Mandalorian a lot of the time, but he also is, there are credited stand-ins. So sometimes it's not. It's obviously sometimes it's a stuntman too, but I'm really curious to hear what goes into the performance, in this dark, flame-filled room. Emily Swallow brings to life the armorer. Is it time to drop our code names for the child? You know, we were using these code names as a way of people being able to communicate about it over social media without spoiling that there's a baby Yoda. We were calling him Green Moses was a good one. And,
Shamrock Shake.
Some people online are calling him Pistachio. I mean, what do you think? When Jon Favreau put out a piece of concept art showing Baby Yoda, I feel like that was just like, okay, everybody can talk about Baby Yoda now.
Yeah, Jon Favreau tweeted it. The official Star Wars account has tweeted some images. So, like, I feel like gloves are off. We, you know, hopefully you're not listening to this, but my apologies to UK listeners and other listeners. I know Disney Plus won't be there until March of next year. I'm sorry that you can't enjoy Baby Yoda along with the rest of us. That is a disappointment, I'm sure. But, we, you know, hopefully they're not listening to this and we will be here for them in podcast form when they finally get the episodes of The Mandalorian. I don't know. I think we should keep Shamrock Shake. It's sort of taken off.
All right.
I don't know if you saw, one of our listeners, when watching the second episode, made a cocktail that was called the Green Moses with like Midori in it.
Ooh.
And then had Shamrock Shakes for dessert. And they made like a whole meal, but like our two names for Yoda made it into, you know, dessert and drink form.
I like that. So Midori, what was it? We'll have to find the user. and
yes.
give that person a shout out. So I like Maduri in a drink. That's yummy. But what would you put in a Shamrock Shake drink?
Creme de menthe.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. A little bit of vanilla ice cream and some, is that how you pronounce it? Creme de menthe?
Or, you know, that's the snooty way of saying it. You say creme de menthe or whatever. My my grandma used to make
cream de menthe.
I think the drink is called a grasshopper or something like that. And that has like a nice, it was my grandma's drink from the 1950s and it has creme de menthe in it. But yeah, I would definitely put that in a Shamrock Shake. I will see if I can find, the user before the episode is through and I will shout them out. They tweeted a photo of the drink and it actually kind of looked, delicious. Obviously, Maduri is a very, very good drink. So yeah, if you want to make a drink and let us know what you're drinking while you're watching The Mandalorian, we would love to hear those. You can, once again, you can email us stillwatchingpod@gmail.com. I'm going to start with an email that we got, last week from Ian after we were talking about, the concept of force healing, sort of this idea of like, what was the little Shamrock Shake trying to do at the beginning of episode two when it was, you know, it's squinting its eyes and holding out his hand in the direction of Mando's wound. I say force healing. Anthony's like, what is, that's not a thing, Joanna.
But it is apparently, you know, that it's something from Expanded Universe. Also, I found the user. Director.
Oh, great.
Director Bennick, Zen Kenobi. 5 days ago, we had the Mandalorian watch party tonight. I made this cocktail called the Green Moses to celebrate. It is ugly, delicious. Green Moses recipe. 1.5 ounces of Maduri, 1 ounce coconut rum, 1 ounce Yum. Pineapple juice, 0.5 ounces of lemon juice. Sounds very vacation-y.
Yeah, trip to the beach. Love it.
Well, very sandy locations where we've been so far.
Trip to the ocean dunes of Karnak or something like that. Anyway.
All right. Sorry to derail.
Excellent. No. Thank you for finding that. So if you want to make your own drinks and tweet at us, you can find us individually on Twitter. You can email us. All right. So Ian wrote in last week, hey guys, love the podcast. On the question of force healing, I think you're right that it hasn't yet been shown in new canon, although prevalent in almost every Star Wars video game. Obviously, there are examples in new canon of Force abilities showing up that weren't previously shown on screen, like Luke projecting himself in The Last Jedi. Interestingly, I think there are also examples of new abilities being introduced in other sources of canon, and especially in the animated shows that later make their way into the films. For example, in Rebels, Kanan was ejected into space and pulled himself back in using the Force, much the same way that Leia would later do so in The Last Jedi. The Force connection between Rey and Kylo Ren was also foreshadowed somewhat in Rebels with Ezra and Maul's connection, as well as how Ezra communicated with Yoda. My hunch is that introducing Force healing in The Mandalorian may be a Lucasfilm prepping the audiences for a similar display in The Rise of Skywalker. Purely speculation, obviously, but that is immediately where my mind went. Anyway, keep up the great work, and I've eagerly devoured each episode so far. Look forward to the rest. Ian. Thank you, Ian.
Thanks, Ian. Good letter.
Great letter. Can you take a second, Anthony, to let our listeners know who might not know the difference between canon, what is canon, what is legends, and what happened there when Lucasfilm sort of consolidated its storytelling?
Yeah, when Lucasfilm decided in 2012 to be sold off to Disney and that new projects would be developed, new film and TV shows. We had something, a little break in how things, had been progressing to that point where there were a lot of novels and particularly books. I would say everything that was like on screen seems to be, decidedly canon, but there were so many books and so many that go back years and years and years. I mean, to early Lando books and things like the first Star Wars novel, Splinter of the Mind's Eye, which came out even before, Empire Strikes Back, or I'm a little fuzzy on exactly the timeline there, but it was like Splinter of the Mind's Eye was Luke and Leia ending up on a planet called Mimban, which we ended up seeing in Solo, a Star Wars story. That's the Mud World, and they have a confrontation with Vader. It's kind of like a pre-Dagobah, right? And so you have all this storytelling that people consumed and really loved, the Timothy Zahn trilogy, for instance, which came out after all the original trilogy had played out, and this was like the first big Star Wars storytelling movement of the 1990s. People love those books. They love Thrawn. And yet yet all that storytelling kind of got not erased, like your books didn't disappear from the shelf. It's just that Lucasfilm said those aren't official stories. So if you're saying this happened and therefore we can't actually explore it in film, that's not the case. We're erasing all of that. And then people like Dave Filoni would pick and choose specific things that he wanted.
Right.
People like the screenwriters for Solo, John and Lawrence Kasdan, decided, well, we're gonna pull Mimbin back out of this novel Splinter of the Mind's Eye, and we're gonna make that the Mud World where Han Solo goes and has a big battle as an Imperial trooper. And that kind of thing has been happening a lot, where they pull things from what has now become known as legends. And
right.
made them part of the official storytelling. And in fact, Yoda in Rebels, I believe it was in Rebels, and he may have also said it in the Clone Wars, had this saying of there's always a bit of truth in legends. Yoda said it, and a couple of other characters had said it on Rebels. And, that was Dave Filoni's way of saying, if you want to believe, we'll pull some of these things from the legends back into the, we'll re-canonize them. And that's been happening a lot. You see it happening with Thrawn. And so if they're going back and mining this material and saying, here's some cool stuff that let's put that back into the official storytelling. So sorry if that's a little bit of a long explanation, but
no.
may be confused. Like basically they just said, we're starting from scratch, but we're also going to maybe pull a couple of those old classic elements back into the official storyline.
Basically, they've given themselves the possibility to use almost any and all of it that doesn't contradict the story that they're already doing.
Exactly.
But also freed themselves from the shackles of being beholden to all this EU storytelling that's been, you know, going on for decades.
And I wrote about this a little before The Mandalorian came out. Folks can find this story over on VanityFair.com. And I explored why they used IG-11 instead of IG-88, why they created the Mandalorian instead of just saying, let's pull Boba Fett out of the Sarlacc and have another story with him. It's because there were existing storylines for a lot of the classic recognizable characters, and they didn't want to erase those. You know,
right.
They didn't want to say, no, that didn't happen.
Yeah.
This is what happened, because people did have an investment in it. And the writers and creators who made those things way back when also had an investment. So they were just like, we're going to use something that looks similar, has a similar function, but we're going to give it a new personality and a new story.
Right. So as we try to explain, you know, to people who might need some help, what's going on in The Mandalorian, you know, using Anthony's encyclopedic knowledge of stuff, we might reference legend stuff. You know, obviously canon is only canon, but legends can help us inform at least what material they're looking at as they're making this story. And so I used some of that when I was talking about Mandalorian culture in an earlier episode. That's like legends stuff. But what happened to Mandalore, the Purge, the Fall of Mandalore, all of that stuff. There's some of that in the animated shows we talked about. That's canon. But I think that there's, you know, they're creating their own story here about what happened. And we will find out. We found out a few more points of data this week. So anyway, that's canon versus legends, if you were curious. The story group at Lucasfilm sort of is the keeper of all of this lore. And I do want to let people know, we have an interview with the director of this episode, Deborah Chow. So if you stick around to the end of the episode, you will hear Anthony talking to Deborah Chow.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
you know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Should we dive into the episode, Anthony?
Yeah, let's do it. There's a very specific thing that I don't even know if you would consider this part of Legends, because I don't know that it was actually a part of any official storytelling, really. But it's the Camp Tono that Werner Herzog's client gives to the Mandalorian later. That's one of my favorite little pieces of, like, almost, I would call it fan fiction, like fan lore, something that fans focused on, fixated on, and based on literally like less than a second of footage from The Empire Strikes Back. And now it's part of official Star Wars storytelling.
Okay, so
we'll get to
that.
We'll get to that about, it comes through about like halfway through our recap. So let's begin with when we last left the Mandalorian.
For now, we are exactly, when we last left the Mandalorian, he was speeding away from one planet, which is definitely not Tatooine. I've been told by many people, Anthony was right. I was deeply wrong. Not that I was sure. I was just question mark. And Anthony's like, no, but it definitely is not. It's listed under the, character Queel, under his, sort of data, character data from Lucasfilm. It says which planet he's on. It is not Tatooine. So, but you know, they were once again, like Anthony said, they're trying to like invoke these familiar things. So invoke Tatooine with the moisture farming and the Jawas of episode two, but not mess with Tatooine, right?
Apparently it's called Arvala 7.
Exactly.
So I'm guessing that's the name of somebody's best friend from high school.
Kim Arvala, congratulations. You now have a planet name.
Kim Arvala, man. Remember 1997? Great times.
So when the episode starts, it's, I believe the first shot is the Mandalorian sort of like coming out of, like a hyperdrive. Like it's sort of that one of the, those classic like, shoo. Yeah, sort of back into normal speed, out of Ludacris and Plaid, back into normal speed. And we get this shot that like I wrote down in my notes when we watched it as, this is what happens when I let my cat roam around my car when I take her to the vet. The baby's just on the loose in the spaceship, out of the crib, roaming around, messing with things. And then what happens, Anthony?
The baby takes the knob off of the hyperdrive, switch. And, you know, Mando's kind of irritated with this. You know, again, it's like a little game of fetch. There's a bit, I know we call him Baby Yoda. He's kind of like Puppy Yoda in a way, too.
Oh, like, I actually think he's more of a cat, but maybe.
Kitten-like. That's the ears, I think.
Yeah.
For sure. And I'm a cat person, so.
But also, like the long nap that happened in episode two. Mm-hmm. And like not being helpful, maybe exactly when Mando needed, like not reliably helpful.
Yeah, you're right. Definitely more of a. There's definitely more of a cat thing.
That's a cat. The dog would be there for you. The cat's like, I'm napping now. Sorry, I can't help you. So,
I was thinking like the playful. You're right. But you know, you're right. The cat would bat that little knob from the hyperdrive right under the couch. Right
like
under
the cat.
Right under the carbon freeze. Like, great.
Like when the cat just knocks your mug off the counter while making eye contact with you. And you're like, great stuff. Anyway, so, it's a deeply cute moment. We should talk about the way in which the Shamrock Shake has exploded on social media now that people feel free to post images. It's been a Yoda fest on my Twitter feed. I don't know about yours.
It has. I mean, a little bit of cute overload here because, it's like cuteness in Star Wars doesn't always work because you have think back to like the Ewoks and how people rebelled against the Ewoks because what are these cute little teddy bear creatures in my Star Wars? This isn't cool. And, I think this is a case of where, weirdly, everybody seems to like it. Like, when was the last time that happened on any front? When
did
everybody
like
anything?
Yeah. I feel like we've all rallied around Baby Yoda, and it's like the light we need to get us through the end of this decade. Just cling to Baby Yoda.
There's just I just haven't seen any dissent on Baby Yoda sucks. And so, good job. Like, most Star Wars people just, like, they just rebel against cuteness. And, or not most, but some. There's just a contingent who just always wanted to be more metal than it ever was. And Baby Yoda somehow just seems to have warmed everybody's hearts. Like, I just, it has ended hostilities around the world. People have laid down arms. Gargamel issued a statement saying he apologizes to the Smurfs for tormenting them, that he was wrong about trying to turn them into gold. And, like, I just expect every villain to go, oh, you know, Baby Yoda, that's going to be the resolution of the Rise of Skywalker. It's like, the Emperor is going to have the good guys on the ropes, force lightning them to death, and then suddenly somebody's going to, like, activate a hologram of Baby Yoda, and he's going to be like, oh, man.
Or just, like, hold up Baby Yoda like Simba or something like that.
Yeah, what have, like... what
have I done? There is beauty in this world. Yeah.
It's like the Martha. Your mom's name is Martha, too?
Yes, that classic bit of storytelling.
Yeah, just classic. Iconic.
Yeah, I mean, you know, BB-8 works pretty well, I think, on people. The cuteness of BB-8.
That's true, yeah.
And the cuteness of the Porgs, but I do think that this is a next level.
Even Porgs had haters, though.
Oh, for sure.
And there was also a dark side to Porgs, like when Chewie's roasting a Porg. There's like, they're cute, but also, let's eat these things.
It's funny because I don't know if you remember that Patton Oswalt bit where he's talking about the prequels and he's talking about... you know that thing you liked? Well, what if it was like a little kid, like talking about Darth Vader and Anakin and stuff like that? And the joke of that is like, you don't want that. You don't want to see that. Mm-hmm. But this is very much like, hey, you all love Yoda. What if Yoda was a little kid and super cute? And it is working on everyone. So I'm not mad about it at all. So the other thing we see on the ship is we get a little hologram of Greef Karga being like, Mando, take the bounty directly to, you know, the client. Do not stop. Do not, you know, pass go. Like, go directly there. And, he says, I don't know. He says something like, I don't know if he wants to eat him or like hang him on a wall, but like take him in that, you know, directly. And so we get this scene between Werner Herzog, Dr. Pershing, poor abused Dr. Pershing is back, and the Mandalorian. And this, I think, is when your favorite prop appears.
He gets paid. He gets his Camptono of Beskar steel, which is this white sort of computerized drum that you enter a code and it opens up and there's the sweet, sweet, delicious Mandalorian metal inside. And the Camptono was a new word for it. That term actually comes from, I guess, a viral video of a little kid talking about ice cream, and she makes up the word Camptono to talk about ice cream. Now, keep the ice cream thing in the back of your mind, a little brain freeze floating around back there, because, okay, this is going to seem like we go very, very deep into the tall grass. And like, in Empire Strikes Back, there's a scene where Lando is trying to get Leia and Chewie off of Cloud City after Han is frozen. There's panic at this disco. The Empire has shown up and is openly, taking over, changing the deal on Lando. Lando's got to get out. And one of the valiant citizens of Cloud City sprints past him. Man in a kind of a orange jumpsuit, has what looks a little bit like Morris Day and the Time hair. He's carrying a big white drum. That is, we now know in the year 2019 is a Camptono. And this did not become a phenomenon until like the DVD era and the freeze frame possibility, because this guy literally goes by in a blink. But when you could suddenly freeze this movie and watch it frame by frame, people were like, who is this? Who is this pot-bellied man carrying what is apparently a commercial ice cream maker from the late 1970s. That's the object. It looks a little bit futuristic, I guess. So somebody was like, here, run with this. You're carrying this. You're evacuating with this. Nobody even really knows who this actor is. It's just some background guy, probably you know, got paid as a couple of bucks to run around on the set of Empire Strikes Back in 1979. But he's not somebody who's out there or identity is even known. He certainly isn't at conventions. But the character was given the name by fans of Wilrow Hood. And people were so tickled by him. And he looks like such an unconventional Star Wars character because he's a little, like, he's middle-aged. He's kind of plump, you know. He's got, like, an obvious pot belly in this orange jumpsuit of his. And he's carrying an ice cream machine. So people were like, oh, this is a brave Mr. Cone. This is, like, a Mr. Softy who's fleeing Cloud City with his homemade ice cream recipe that he doesn't want to fall into the hands of the Sith and evildoers. And so people just were making up these crazy theories. And Star Wars, which apparently had some time on its hands in the late 2000s, decided to make him canon. So they put out like a trading card. I think he was in like a trading card game that this guy's name was Wilrow Hood. And they upped his cred a little bit by saying he was not like a fleeing ice cream dispenser, but he contained some rebel refueling information. So that would have been valuable military information that he didn't want to fall into the Empire's hands, that apparently like Cloud City had been supplying to Banna Gass to the rebels. So like, we don't want to give them any info about who we're communicating with. So we're going to destroy this or escape with it. Hasbro made an action figure. I have it in a box on my wall.
Do you?
I do. I will tweet a picture of my Wilrow Hood action figure because my brother and I discovered this character like in a Walmart. We were, you know, my brother Greg, when I was visiting him in Iowa, and we went to a Walmart, I think, to pick up like Thanksgiving supplies. And we were looking in the toy section. We're like, who is Wilrow Hood? Apparently he's got an ice cream machine. John Favreau and Dave Filoni, they told me back at Celebration, they're like, you know, John had tweeted a picture of this white drum and he didn't explain what it was. And if you knew, you knew. If you knew who Wilrow Hood was, you knew. And I remember asking, like, well, so what is that? And he said, oh, that's our Camp Tono. And that's like a safe. That's what has the Beskar steel in it. So here's an example of they've taken something that really wasn't even any part of like any kind of official storytelling until the fans came up with it. And came up with some theories, and they've actually made that safe, made that object now as safe. So clearly, whatever Wilrow Hood was fleeing with, it was inside his Camp Tono, his galactic portable safe. And now we have this portable safe delivering to the Mandalorian his Beskar steel. So.
And incredibly, like, I just love what they've done to it to trick it out. You know what I mean? Cause this definitely is just an ice cream maker that they shoved into the arms of an extra.
Yeah. They didn't do anything to dress it up. It's not like when they took like a Bic shaver and they like, you know, they decked it out to be a communications device for the Phantom Menace. Like this was just like, here, just go run.
So, but the version that we see, you know, has got some like switches on it. It's nice and weathered. It's got that good, old antique Star Wars.
It's made a lot of ice cream. Made a lot of ice cream.
A lot of cookies and cream. All right. So the Mandalorian gets his steel but then he asks, what are you going to do with it? And this is a violation, we find out, of the Bounty Hunter Code. And the client gives him a dressing down. He's like, you know, the rules, like once you've delivered the bounty, you're no longer allowed to like, you know, what happens in bounty hunting stays in bounty hunting. You don't talk about it. You don't ask questions about it. That's the code. And, and the Mandalorian just sort of walks away with his steel after that. But, and we see the poor, cute baby being like, you know, floated off into a sinister chamber in the back somewhere. So, is the Mandalorian going to leave the baby in the clutches of the villainous Empire?
And that's the season finale. Yeah. Like, and the Mandalorian was a dick. the end.
And then he's, oh no, no. I was almost going to make a joke about what happened to Baby Yoda, but it's too cute and I can't. So then the next stop that the Mandalorian makes is back to this, sort of hive, this little den of Mandalorians. And we find out, why they're underground. It's something to do with their new Mandalorian culture. They're in hiding, basically, having had their culture destroyed. And they only come above ground one at a time is the sort of rule, so as not to let people know where the concentration of the Mandalorians, the remaining Mandalorians, are.
So when Mando is out and about hunting and gathering, he's the only one.
Yeah, and they all have to sit underground. And this obviously does not sit well with one largish Mandalorian with a very familiar voice. If you didn't catch it, that was Jon Favreau voicing the Mandalorian with a temper, whose temper gives us a nice excuse for some exposition. But basically the Mandalorian comes in, he's got all this steel. The armorer says she can make him a full, cuirass, I think is the name of, I don't know, full suit of Beskar. This is such a flex on behalf of the Mandalorian. And you see it later, like when he's wearing the full suit, you're like that, like, cause Mandalorians don't look like that. They don't look shiny. They always look like battered and scratched. So for him to be like, yes, give me the full suit of Beskar, it's such a flex. What do you think of it?
Yeah. I mean, when he shows up at the cantina, you know, dressed to the nines, I think there's also a little bit of silliness about it. It's sort of like, not that it's a joke, but that he just seems so out of place. It's like when Jim Carrey shows up in Dumb and Dumber, like in the blue tuxedo, just like, you're overdressed, you're overdone, like, you now stick out really badly, you know?
Yeah.
And it's sort of like flashing a wallet full of money in a den of thieves, like, oh, now everybody's like, oh, he thinks he's somebody, right?
It's like doing a job and then like get, you know, showing up drippy and ice. You know what I mean? It's like, everyone's like, okay, you're putting a target on your back pretty much, son.
You want to be like Robert De Niro in Goodfellas. You're not supposed to spend the money. What is with this coat? Why'd you buy this car?
Return the car.
Get the car. Get out of here.
So before we get to that moment where I think he looks like a lot like RoboCop, but like before we get to that moment, let's go back to this fight in the Mandalorian underground. The Mandalorian voiced by Jon Favreau says these are the spoils of the Great Purge and our world was shattered by the Empire. You know, and we've been reduced to this. So we get a little bit more information about like why the Mandalorians hate the Empire. And as the armorer is forging this suit for the Mandalorian, we get more flashes of that purge. What do you think of this backstory that's sort of coalescing for this culture?
Well, I like it. And I think it's worth saying you have Favs here voicing a character, but he voiced a character in the Clone Wars called Pre Vizsla, who's a Mandalorian warlord who... spoiler alert, like, doesn't survive. So he would have died probably like a quarter century or more before this story plays out in The Mandalorian. So it's not the same guy. Right. Maybe a descendant. Who knows?
Like his cousin.
Like, I'm kind of curious. Cousin Vizsla, you know? Pre Vizsla also is like pre-visualization is a big thing among filmmakers and became so like about 15 years ago where you did digitally create a version of the movie. Kind of like a little bit almost too on the nose as a little tip of the hat to visual effects artists out there. Well, I mean, yeah. But to directors and visual effects artists, it's like a little bit of an in-joke for them. But that's just as an aside. I think, you know, you get this character here who is clearly not happy that he has to stay underground and that Mando is out there, actually doing pretty well by the tribe, right? By the group. He's bringing back the resources, so you can't really fault him for that. But then, I think there's obviously, it's good to create a little bit of tension here. And I like the idea of this proud class that has been destroyed and a proud culture that's been destroyed. And I think our previous episode, I said the Mandalorians are kind of like, they dress differently, but they exist in the same time as everybody else, but they like to keep to themselves that they're a bit like maybe Amish or Mennonite, like, but warrior versions of that. And now, you know, this part kind of reminded me a bit of like Native Americans, a proud culture, a strong culture that just is overwhelmed and in through war and greed is destroyed almost to the point of extinction. It's almost, I hesitate to use such a heavy term here, but it's like an extinction or a genocide of their people. And
absolutely.
You see them, I think, but I'm actually glad that Star Wars did this because it is Star Wars. And I think you have to show that there are consequences beyond just the pew, pew, pew and the fun space battles and all that, is that here's a group of people, including a bunch of little masked kids who are decimated and demolished and broken and living in pretty squalid conditions.
So, the armor says to be a Mandalorian is to be both hunter and prey. And how can one be a coward if one chooses this way of life? This is the way. We get this repeated sort of this is the way intonation in that scene. And what I feel like we're seeing in this episode, I really like this episode for these thematics of codes, because we hear a bit about what the Mandalorian code is. You don't take the helmet off. You don't let anyone take your helmet off. This is the way. We only come up one man, Mandalorian at a time. This is the way, sort of thing. And then we heard about the bounty hunter code. And so this idea that the Mandalorian is at a place, I think, where he's in conflict. And the reason why they keep talking about the foundlings are the future. Like, we do everything for the foundlings. The Mandalorian culture, a lot of it is founded on these children who are abandoned, who are brought into the Mandalorian culture and raised as Mandalorian. Like, Jango Fett, adopted Mandalorianism, but wasn't, born on Mandalore. And so this idea of adoption and foundlings, because I'm not even convinced that Pedro Pascal's character, like the kid that we see in the flashback, I'm not even convinced he was born a Mandalorian. I think he was found, abandoned, and brought into the Mandalorian tribe. This is his adopted family. And so this idea of protection of lost children seems to be really hammered into the Mandalorian culture. Correct me if any of this sounds wrong to you. And so the bounty hunter code mandates that he turns over this small thing to the client and not ask any questions. That's the bounty hunter code. But the Mandalorian code seems to say, no, you should be protecting this child. So what do you do as a Mandalorian out in the world when your two codes come into conflict? You know?
I love this. You told me you were going here before we began recording, this idea of conflicting codes and believing two things and the dissonance that creates inside your head, inside your helmet of what you believe, what your personal code, what you owe to your culture and your society. And that's always what the gunslinger stands for, right? Is this personal integrity, but also standing up for what's right in his or her culture. And, you get this here. This is, you can read it in the face mask and the performance, the physical performance that Pedro Pascal gives. There's a tension and a coiled quality to the Mandalorian. He's not sure he's doing the right thing. Also, by we're maybe getting a little bit ahead here, but he has a choice to make about what to do with Baby Yoda, whether to leave him or not, whether to break that code. And that means breaking which a promise to his tribe, too.
Well, yeah, which code to break, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
Sort of. Mm-hmm. But yeah, and then it puts his tribe at risk. He wasn't trying to put them at risk, but it does put them at risk because they rush to help him. Can I read you a favorite crackpot theory of mine that comes from a listener, Kat? So it's about if Pedro's character was not born a Mandalorian, then like, do we have any context clues as to who he might be? I mean, he might just be a Mandalorian. When they talk about the Great Purge, we get flashbacks to him seemingly on the run. Would there be Mandalorians who didn't wear, armor? Like, 'cause his parents are running around without armor on. So like, does that look Mandalorian to you? What do you think about that, Anthony?
Well, I mean, you don't always have to wear armor. You know, we've certainly seen on Rebels Mandalorian characters take their armor off. We saw that in the Clone Wars. So I think it's possible they were not. I mean, not everybody can be a warrior, you know, even in
right.
tribal cultures, you have your warriors and then you have your civilians essentially. So, and it wouldn't necessarily be practical. And somebody like Sabine Wren, the character voiced by, Tia Sirkar on Rebels, like she had her helmet off all the time. So it wasn't, I mean, it's possible that they could be Mandalorians and not be battle ready. But now after being beaten down, that they're always battle ready, that they're always prepped for conflict. So,
right.
You know.
Yeah. It's an interesting, this idea of a very martial culture and what mm-hmm. drives you to be a martial culture, is really interesting to me. But Kat writes in her theoretical speculation. If being a foundling means that he is not a Mandalorian by birth, but an orphan raised in that culture, she says, I don't necessarily think that. I've just heard it thrown around. I have a theory about where he's from. The leathery bracelet/ornaments that appear in his flashback look an awful lot like Holdo's from The Last Jedi. And in Leia, Princess of Alderaan, which is a book, they mention that Holdo's outfits are unusual because most people from Gatalenta wear only one color, their traditional red cloaks. So, we see the Mandalorian and his parents in flashback, or seemingly his parents, his guardians, in red cloaks. And then it's true that the like leather detailing that's on his costume and the bracelets of the people wearing him do, I will admit, bear an uncanny resemblance to the ones that Holdo wears in The Last Jedi. So, just a theory, a question mark. Nobody is, you know, throwing down all their money on this theory, but you know, just something to keep in mind. It's fun to
I
fun
love
to
these
see.
Theories.
Yeah, and to think about how costume design might influence, you know, what we're seeing. So, yeah,
very good. I mean, I think this goes to show that no matter how much you know or think you know about Star Wars, it is such a vast canvas that there's always going to be a fan out there who notices something you don't or has a observation, and there's a lot to pull from. So good job.
So we go to sort of sew up this whole Mandalorian lore chat. The armor, when she's making his armor, brings up this topic of a signet again. We've heard it before. We hear it again. And this idea, my understanding now, I think, of a signet, we talked about a little before, is sort of like the Mandalorian culture. They have these houses, right? You head of houses, very much like on Game of Thrones. And so I think the signet is sort of like, what will your house, you know, your sigil be, basically? You know, and he says he got the Beskar because he defeated a Mudhorn, but he does not want the Mudhorn signet as his signet because, you know, the baby helped him do that. And, you know, he feels conflicted about that. So she gives him these little weapons, these little whistling birds, instead, which he blows before the episode's over, by the way. So, you know, so much.
Yeah, there's more whistling birds where that came from, right?
I hope so. But yeah, so that's, I mean, is there anything else you want to say about sort of the info dump of Mandalorian culture we get in this sequence?
Well, do we feel that this season is going to end with him getting a signet that looks like a Yoda?
I mean, that's what I was thinking, but it seems like a very silly looking signet, a baby Yoda signet. You know what
like
I mean?
I have like a cookie cutter Yoda that I think.
Yeah. Could stamp that into some Beskar. Maybe there's like a really cool stylized way to do it. You know what I mean? Like, you know, like a half circle for the head and then sort of like, I don't know, triangles, but like cut. I don't know. I'm envisioning something in my head that could look cool, but I think it needs to be like stylized. It can't be like cute.
It can't be like Hello Kitty. You know, yeah. Like, yeah. It's gotta be something. I mentioned how Star Wars fans want things to be a little metal. We're talking about actual metal here, so it has to be, it has to be a little more badass than, it can't just be like I said, oh, cute little baby Yoda is your signet. Great.
Yeah, no, you'd be kicked out of the hive. Anyway, so, we get the Mandalorian leaves in this full suit of Beskar that puts a target on his back because he just looks too flashy. goes into the bounty hunter bar, and Grief Karga's like, none of you got this is my only friend. you're my associate. He flashes that he got himself a little bit of Beskar, a little percentage, of the deal, and that comes to play later, but I liked the way it did not set alarms off for me when he flashed that. I wasn't like, oh, obviously that's going to come into play later. So mm-hmm. I thought that was really tidily done. And then he just dropped some fun, Star Wars, locations and concepts on us, like the Twi'lek healing baths. Is that something that you're aware of in canon or legends? It sounds very evocative to me.
Do I sound derelict if I say, is there going to be some erotic novel about the Twi'lek healing baths? You know, like it just sounds. That just sounds a little too grown up for Star Wars. I don't know. The healing, I guess maybe it's just healing baths. Sorry, did I go to a bad place?
No. You're like the Twi'lek massage parlor where they
Twi'lek bathhouses. I don't know. It just seems a little, maybe. I don't know.
Well, and then he also talks about spice, a canton of spice that, I think the phrase he uses is like, when you come out of hyperdrive, you like will forget anything that happened, and hyperdrive being sort of like a euphemism for a trip. So, he's talking
about what stays in hyperspace. What happens in hyperspace stays in hyperspace.
So, and then he offers him a bounty, on the ocean dunes of Karnak. This is just a great Star Wars phrase, the ocean dunes of Karnak. But basically he offers him like a nobleman who skipped bail. Here's a good job you could do, or you can go report these, stormtrooper motherfuckers to the New Republic. And the Mandalorian says, that's a joke. So that's our information on how the new government that Leia's trying to build, or whoever's trying to build, is going. It's considered a joke, 5 years after Return of the Jedi. So that's all happening. The Mandalorian fires up his ship. He's going to go forget this baby. He's got a shiny new suit, a new mission. He's just going to go and forget it all. And then, of course, no, he powers the ship down, gets out. And then most ominously of all, he's snooping around. He sees that adorable space crib in the dumpster.
Terrible.
The space dumpster.
But it's reaching for that hyperdrive switch, man, that he notices. What gets him. That's what makes him think of his little kitty cat Yoda baby.
His kitty cat Yoda baby. And so this is a moment that I wanted to dive into really quickly with you, Anthony, which is there have been, people are really into Baby Yoda. I think people are into the Mandalorian generally, obviously. But, I constantly am hearing about this topic that you and I addressed since the beginning, which is how can I emotionally connect with a character who is always masked? And, for some people it's working, and for some people it doesn't. And, for some people, Darth Vader, you could see a lot of emotion in just the like body work, of Darth and the voice work of Darth Vader. And for some people you can't. And I'm going to say is like your best shot so far, I think, of really connecting with this Mandalorian character, mask or no, is in this shot where he sees the crib, and it's the combination of music and sort of like whatever either Pedro or whoever's in the suit at the time was like doing with the body work really worked for me for this silent decision that the Mandalorian makes here. Do you have any thoughts of how it's going so far with the mask and the emotions?
It's working for me, partly because it's the Mandalorian is not supposed to have emotions. So he's not supposed to ask questions, and it works like the Clint Eastwood squint for me. Is that he just there's a stoicism about his face by way of the mask that you're not able to read. It's the ultimate poker face because it's not even a face. So you're reading little cues from the body language, but you're also picking up the emotion. I think Ludwig Göransson's music is really doing a lot of the lift on what you're supposed to be feeling. And those combinations, I mean, that's teamwork. That's filmmaking. So the combination of the camera moves, the music, the the lack of motion of the actor, the stillness and the choices there really do convey as much emotion as we need. And also, it's a bit of a blank screen that we project our own emotions to.
Yeah, I love that.
It makes the audience reach out a little further. It's kind of like in an interview when you're dealing with somebody who's very quiet or doesn't, or gives you very stilted answers, very short answers, and you just wait them out. And then they give you a little more, and you make them meet you.
Yeah, a rookie mistake.
Rather than rushing to fill the void.
Who knew that Anthony and Joanna would give you some interview advice? But yeah, I think a rookie mistake, one that I made plenty of times, is to try to fill in that space yourself with more talking. But if you're quiet and if you wait, usually your subject will give you unpeel the onion one more layer for you. You know, if I had to guess, I would guess we get the helmet off in the finale. That seems like a good finale reward for us. It might come sooner. I don't know. But it's a journey there. You know what I mean? Like, they talk about in this episode, you don't take the mask off. You're masked. You're closed in. I like the word you use, coiled. Mm-hmm. This idea of like this refugee kid who was orphaned, has a lot of pain, is on a determined mission to like bring money back to his people. And then this unbearably cute thing starts to crack him open, mm-hmm. you know? So
who betrays less emotion and more stoicism? Pedro Pascal's The Mandalorian or Olivia Colman's Queen Elizabeth II in the season 3 of The Crown?
It's a good question.
I feel like the Mando would have gone to Aberfan much sooner.
Yes, and not dressed Charles down for his Welsh speech.
Did you show emotion?
So the Mandalorian is, you know, he sees the crib. I don't know. It's almost like fist clench. Okay, what am I going to do? He spies on the client and the doctor, and the client saying like, extract what you need. So this is an extraction situation. Extract what you need and be done with it. And the doctor's like, we were told to bring the thing back alive. And the client says, I can no longer guarantee your safety. So this is, you know, this is the conflict we've already seen. We see a little bit of, more of it a few minutes later because the Mandalorian comes in, just, you know, blows everyone out of the water to get to the baby, gets to the baby. It's in this contraption. And Dr. Pershing goes like, please don't like kill me. Please don't. If it weren't for me, like he genders the baby. There's been some questions about that, but Dr. Pershing fairly clearly says he would not be alive if it weren't for me. And so the Mandalorian spares Dr. Pershing because he like believes him but grabs the baby out of the contraption and goes. And then uses some whistling birds on some particularly bad guys as he tries to get out of there. Do you have any thoughts, Anthony? We have only watched this episode once. We haven't had a chance to freeze frame the device. I'm sure all of you on Reddit will be doing that. But do you have any thoughts about sort of the medical procedure that we see in this episode?
Well, I think what's happening here is clearly Baby Yoda has some force abilities. And this is one of the things that some Star Wars people really dislike that George Lucas applied to the Force in the prequels, which was the midichlorians, and the idea that there's like a science-based aspect to it. And I can only imagine that's the information they're trying to extract. Maybe some, you know, genetic information, but also they're trying to harvest an understanding of the biochemical, physical elements that would give this being its powers. And that to me I like it in this show because to me, that's like the betrayal of the spiritual side of the Force, where there's like an intuitive understanding and a connection that you make on an otherworldly level. But this is like, we're just going to crack open this baby and we're going to, and harvest the data. That to me is like a betrayal of everything the Force stands for, but also like a legitimate exploitation of it. And it shows bad guys using the Force to their own means. And, you know, for instance, kyber crystals have a similar like spiritual sacred component in Force lore. And it gets, turned into a super satellite weapon that destroys whole worlds. And so I like that aspect that they're acknowledging the supernatural side of it, but they're using science to crack it and dissolve it and create something new.
Right. So we could see potentially force wielding clones or something like that is an idea yeah. of what might be afoot here.
Exactly.
Yeah.
What if you create an army of force wielders?
Yeah. Yikes. So, you know, and Dr. Pershing, you know, is kind of a classic figure, a classic Western murky morality figure. Like, he's working with these people. We don't know why. Maybe he, you know, maybe they have his family. Who knows what he's working under duress, and he's trying to protect this baby while still doing their bidding. So he gets spared. Is this the last we'll see of him? I would guess not, but, no. You know, who knows? The whistling birds are launched. You say there's more whistling birds where those came from. I was waiting for them to return. Like, they, you know, these things, these really cool weapons, like, launch out of his gauntlets, take down all these, you know, stormtroopers trying to stop him. And then I was waiting for them to, like, come back to roost in his gauntlets, and they didn't. I was like, well, that's a, I mean, if you're
it's
a scavenger.
Like Bugs Bunny. It's like Bugs yeah. Bunny. Ah, it's a great trick, but it only works once, you know, like.
Yeah. If you're a scavenger, if you're a Jawa, you might want to dig through those bodies for little Beskar bullets that are in them right now, I guess. And then we get this great sequence, which is just the Mando. It's a very Western classic sequence of the Mando trying to get to his ship, as all the tracking fobs go off. And every bounty hunter, in the world, in the galaxy, it seems, has probably been activated, to go after the Mandalorian, including his pal Greef Karga, who was so nice to him just a few scenes ago, to try to stop him from taking the baby off planet. What do you make of this showdown?
Well, that, I think Greef is motivated too by the fact that, okay, if one of his people breaks this code, it's going to look bad on him and his whole operation. So you can't do that to us, Mando. That seemed to be what's driving him. But also now there's a new bounty. Get the Mandalorian. Talk about whistling birds. I love when all of the trackers go off. It's like everybody's phone lighting up.
Uh-huh. It's like, well, doesn't that happen at the end of, not to spoil it, but John Wick 2, I think? You like find out that, I don't know if you've seen John Wick 2, but at the end, you know, he's walking through, I think it's like Central Park or someplace, and like everyone's phone goes off and they freeze, and you realize that every single person you're looking at is an assassin. And you're sort of like, how does, you know, it's like a really murderous flash mob. You're like, how does society work this way? Anyway, so yeah, every bounty hunter is on the lookout for the Mandalorian, which is a great premise for, you know, the rest of the season. He's on the run. Every bounty hunter is looking for him, including, we might suspect, the character that Ming-Na Wen is playing, including possibly the Twi'lek that we've seen in trailers, played by Natalia Tanya. Yeah, Bill Burr, you know, like, basically he's just going to be dodging these bounty hunters for the rest of the season is my guess. Once again, that's speculation. We don't know. But
Cara Dune could also be.
Cara Dune. Hunter,
right?
Friend or foe, friend or foe, we'll see. But he gets on this speeder, and it's very like covered wagon. Get me to, I was thinking 310 to Yuma, right? But it's just sort of like, get me on the train and then I'm out of here. The real rescue is the Mandalorians come, and help him out, led by the one voiced by Jon Favreau. I was watching this. So I, the screening that I got to go to in San Francisco, in the screening event that you went to in LA, I think these were called fan events. So some press was there, but mostly it was fans, and the fans that were at my screening are these diehard, you know, they have these, I don't know if you've ever been to like a Star Wars screening or a fan event or whatever, they wear these like matching motorcycle sort of Hell's Angels jackets. And, I had a big group, that's called the Wolves of Mandalore. And Dave Filoni actually talked about them during the Q&A before the screening, how he like has dinner with them at Celebration every year and stuff like that. And they're this, you know, they just like, they're this lovely, like rowdy bunch of like, they look like bikers, but their helmets are Mandalorian helmets. Like, and they were in my screening and they like basically howled when all the Mandalorians sort of like came on screen and started firing and fighting. What happened in your screening when this big moment came?
Just big cheers went up. Yeah, you know, my little girl cheered and was super excited to see. It's just nice. I think it's refreshing to see people come together and fight for someone, you know, that idea of unity. And even if you're not thinking about that consciously, it's just kind of cool to see these folks like flying around using all of the cool abilities and powers that we always knew Boba Fett had that he never quite deployed.
Right.
It was finally cool. It was cool to see them in action, but also see them working for good, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. We've been talking about codes and families, right? And so what's true is that Mando's bounty hunter family, if you ever wanted to call it that, completely turned on him, including Greef Karga, who was so paternalistic to him earlier, completely turned on him. And the Mandalorians, who were hostile towards him, showed up for him. So this shows him that he made, I think, the right choice in terms of which code to listen to. You know what I mean? The bounty hunters are never going to be there for him. They're out for themselves. Whereas the Mandalorians are about community, communal identity, and that sort of thing. So that's the clash we get at the end here. Greef Karga, you know, sneaks away to try to trap the Mando on his own ship. A nice sneaky move. And he gets shot in the chest for his troubles. And, but is saved by the Beskar Steel. This, of course, is a classic, this is a Clint Eastwood move. This is
Fistful of Dollars.
Marty McFly. Yep, Marty McFly move. Or oftentimes you'll see it in things where it'll be like a Bible. Cause it was like a breast pocket thing, right? So it'll be like a Bible has saved you. I've seen that in a bunch of movies.
Yeah.
Or in, Batman, I think it's like a silver serving tray or something like that, that Michael Keaton shoved down his shirt. So, you know. This is a classic Western move. Love to see it. And the Mando flies off and we see, once again, that Mandalorian character played by Jon Favreau flies up with that jetpack, which is a Boba Fett thing. And what does the Mandalorian says? He goes, I gotta get me one of those.
Yeah.
It's a very Iron Man moment for Jon Favreau. That moment right there, right? Like his character that he's voicing, basically he salutes the Mandalorian as he's flying his plane and then sort of zooms off. And it just seems like a very Iron Man move. Or Iron Patriot, either one. And basically the Mandalorians, because they expose themselves, will have to find a new place to hunker down and sort of rebuild and regroup. They expose themselves in order to save Mando. And then the last thing we see, of course, is him screwing off the knob of the hyperdrive and giving it to his little baby companion, Baby Yoda.
Yeah, here you go. Knock yourself out.
Knock yourself out, kid. And we are off. And we are off to who knows where.
Episode 4.
Hiding somewhere, dodging bounty hunters. Is there anything else in this episode that you want to dig into before we move on?
I think that covers it.
All right, let us go now to Anthony's interview with Emily Swallow.
Emily, thank you so much for talking to us today on the Still Watching podcast. My colleague Joanna Robinson and I are having a blast recapping the show and talking about The Mandalorian, and the character of the Armorer is so interesting to us. You have so much mystique and so much mystery surrounding you. You're such an enigma. Tell me about how you got the part of the Armorer.
It's remarkably low key, because when I got the audition, I didn't even really know for sure what I was auditioning for. There hadn't been anything announced that there was going to be a Star Wars series. It had a code name, and my agent said, "We think this has something to do with Star Wars, but you know, the casting director will neither confirm nor deny." So I really had very little information. I had a couple of scenes, and they were very bizarre. You know, I didn't have anything to attach it to. But in some ways, I'm so glad for that now, like now seeing what this has become and how huge it is and how exciting it is, because I didn't really get that worked up about it. And I remember just being in the room with a casting associate and doing it a few different ways on tape. Then at one point he said, you know, why don't you try it with a British accent? Because I guess they'd been mostly seeing Brits for the role. Mm-hmm. So that's how all of that came about. And I did know, like, the little information I had was that she was a leader of these people and very comfortable in a position of like knowing that she had all of their respect. And that, I think, is one of the coolest things for me in playing her, is just trusting that, like, she does have that authority without having to be very forceful at all. She's much more calm, cool, and collected than I could ever be. Mm-hmm. So it's always cool to play somebody like that.
So they told you that this character you were auditioning for was a leader of, like, a tribe? What kind of information did they give you about who she was and what they wanted you to conjure in your performance?
You mean just in the audition?
Yeah, just in the audition part.
Yeah, just in the audition. Yeah, I believe it was that she was a leader of a clan of some sort. I can actually probably... I'm going to look up the audition email on my computer and tell you what information I had.
Real-time research here. This is good.
Yeah. Oh, here we go. Okay. Recurring role of armorer in the Disney streaming service straight to series, untitled high budget.
That's what it is. That's the code name?
Project.
High budget project. Yeah. Got it.
So they said about her... leader, strong, zen, but with authority. Hmm. And that was it.
Oh, wow. Cool. So,
yeah.
I mean, but that gets to the heart of the character. Everything else is just sort of the dressing, the Star Wars trappings and the mask and all that. Did you know that it would be a masked character?
I did. Okay. They made that clear in the audition in case I was like, no way I'm going to do that. But that was really kind of an interesting challenge to me because I started acting in theater and I did a lot of mask training like when I was in grad school, and I'd never gotten to use that in television. When I talked with John and Dave before we started shooting, John talked a lot about Kurosawa and those films, which was something I guess that George Lucas always also drew from when he was making the original movies. And he talked about the samurai and like the simplicity of movement and the efficiency of movement and kind of that unwavering authority that doesn't have to push too hard. And I think that I love that about her. And I feel like that's what sort of lets us know that she knows a lot more than she's letting on, and she will reveal it in good time. But, you know, no one's going to get any information out of her without her being good and ready.
It's interesting that the armorer is considered the leader. Normally, like, a blacksmith would just be a trade worker, you know, but that is what the leader of this group does. Did they discuss much about that dynamic and why that's the case? I guess because the armor is such a key part of who a Mandalorian is.
Yeah, I think because the Mandalorians were traditionally, you know, the warrior part of their tradition is so important to them. So I think that that's probably one of the reasons that she is held in such esteem. And then also because she's the one who makes all this armor, she sort of has, it makes sense to me that she would also be the one who is sort of the keeper of their history and the keeper of their ritual, because she actually has a record based on what it is that she's made and the armor that she's had to replace and the battles that these warriors have gone through. And, you know, when they've come back to her beaten, and when they've come back, and we're starting to get to see a little bit of this with Pedro's character, you know, when they've earned their signet and what distinguishes them in battle, whether it's a, you know, he so far is a Lone Ranger, and so he's earning the signet when he's off on his own. Mm-hmm. But some of them went off to battle together. Some of them have fought. I mean, there's that amazing, amazing moment that just gave me chills at the end of this third episode when they all, those of them that are hidden in this little covert clan, like they totally come to the plate for him, to bat. And they, I feel like they remember the core of who they are and that they are all connected.
Her armor is very interesting. It has a real Spartan quality to it. The ancient Spartan mask is very similar to the way the eye slits are cut. It's also just maybe more ornate and elegant than the other masks. Can you talk to me about what her costume reveals about who she is?
I love that there are those little changes that are so impactful. I mean, I remember when Pedro saw my mask, he was like, wait a minute, why does she get to look so much cooler?
She's the boss.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I don't know everything about the specifics of why they chose all of the details, but I do know, you know, that there was this attempt of sort of communicating a bit of regality, and that she is in a position of leadership over them. I have to say that even though I absolutely love that fur shoulder piece, it sure doesn't seem very practical for someone who is surrounded by fire all the time.
Yeah, right.
But it looks very cool. And I love too the just the detail that I mean I John talked about how they discussed this character and they decided to make it a woman. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to like make it a big deal that they were making a woman. And I love that about it too, that like clearly she is a female and like she even sort of has a skirt. But even that like has such a strong, powerful quality, mm-hmm. That doesn't call too much attention to it. I feel like it's one of the most amazing like combinations of elegant and powerful that I've ever seen in a costume.
Well, that's a good point to make here is that this is the first of the Mandalorian episodes to be directed by a woman, by Deborah Chow. Making the leader of these Mandalorians a woman, it is striking and significant in a way. So what did they tell you about why they made that decision without, again, making a big fuss about it or making it seem unusual?
I think they just sort of felt like, why not? You know, it could go either way. And it's something that that I know we've seen in the animated series. There have been a lot of powerful Mandalorian women, but we haven't gotten to see that as much in the live action Star Wars. And so maybe that played into it a little bit, but I don't think there was like I think it was just sort of like, well, it could be a woman or a man. Wouldn't it be interesting if it was a woman?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How did you devise the voice? You said they said give it a try with an accent. Mm-hmm. What were you going for with the accent? What type of accent did you choose?
Well, I mean, adding some element of like a mid-Atlantic or British dialect to me definitely conveys authority. I mean, I thought a lot about like, you know, Lord of the Rings and characters that I'd seen in that. And I think that also, to me, that contributes to the mystery. I don't know why. Maybe it's because I'm American that I think that it's so interesting.
Well, it does sound more sophisticated. You know, it's a very sophisticated kind of British accent, a very educated person. She's not she's not a Cockney from the, you know, back streets of London. She's from Oxford.
And it sets her apart a little bit. I think it's so interesting, like, that it's, yeah, that it's sort of that educated voice in this warrior figure. And there's just a lot of like seeming contradictions about her that I love.
And so tell me about performing her. So you're in the costume, is your dialogue being recorded? Is there a microphone inside the helmet? Are you being recorded separately?
Inside the helmet. Yeah.
Okay.
And I have to say that the experience of being in the costume is not nearly as dignified as it translates on film.
Oh, really?
I'm really glad that it looks as good as it does. And it was, you know, we were block shooting episodes 1 and 3 at the same time. And so, we were all sort of learning, on the fly, like what the language of these Mandalorian masks was, because we realized, I mean, of course, you can't see our eyes, you can't see our mouths, you can't see like the normal ways of communicating emotion. And we learned that very small movements had a huge impact, which is great, but which is also a challenge because you can wind up communicating something that you don't even want to. And so the simple task of like walking across the room, I would have loved to have been able to like glance down and make sure I wasn't going to trip on something because we had like no peripheral vision, couldn't see down. But if I did that, it would communicate this huge movement that was entirely extraneous. And so there was a lot of trust involved. I was also, for that reason, really glad that she is a very deliberate and slow-moving person. That was helpful. But I also, I mean, I kind of secretly hope that at some point there's a bloopers reel that shows like just how ridiculous it is when you get two Mandalorians or more in a room together. Like we were bumping helmets, we were running into each other and tripping on things. I can't tell you how many times I like dropped my tongs or couldn't pick them up. And all of the action sequences that look so great, where I'm hammering metal and putting things into the fire. Those took a long time to actually capture.
Was there real fire, or is that a visual effect?
No, that's a visual effect.
Oh, that's good. That seems like an OSHA violation.
Oh my gosh.
Let's put her in a helmet where she can't see. Let's drape her in fur, and let's put her next to some
let's just see what happens.
this is episode 3, and we don't really know where it goes from here. Mm-hmm. But I really do hope we see more of the Armorer and learn more about her and learn more about the Mandalorians through her. She seems like a very cool character. But before we let you go, I wanted to ask you about working with Deborah Chow on this episode and what you felt she brought as a special ingredient to Chapter 3 of the Mandalorian story.
I remember, first and foremost, her intense curiosity. Mm-hmm. I felt like it was kind of great having her as the director while I was trying to find this character, because there were lots of things just in her personality that I felt like I could draw from. She's somebody who commands a room in a very graceful and simple way. And she was so curious as we were, you know, like I was saying, like finding the language of these masks and these primitive armor. She gave us time to try different things and to explore different things. And she wanted to see different things and try these interactions in different ways to see what would be communicated. I mean, I remember spending a lot of time with that Beskar steel and stacking it different ways and trying to determine, like, okay, having this massive quantity of this very prized material that had been stolen from our people, having it returned now, knowing that it may, you know, I think that the Armorer senses that it may have been gained through less than noble means.
Even the way it's stamped is kind of like Nazi gold.
Yeah.
Something like
that. Yeah. And that's, they mentioned that. They talked about that a lot. And so trying to determine, like, how that would be handled, how would she place it? How would she look at it? We spent a lot of time with those little details.
Is it your sense that in making this armor, she's purifying it in a way?
I think so, because I think that originally it did come from the Mandalorians. I mean, as she says to one of the Mandalorian riffraff, you know, that raises a fuss and says basically that this is tainted steel, she says the Empire is no more. And it's been returned to its rightful owners, you know, kind of let bygones be bygones. Like, this was ours originally. And sure, it's been tainted. I think more important than whatever evil has transpired is where it came from. And where it came from was a noble place. And we're going to return it to that noble place and give it that noble standing.
Emily Swallow, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you. This was really fun.
All right, let us go now to Anthony's chat with director Deborah Chow.
Hey, Deb, it's so nice to talk to you. Happy debut episode day for The Mandalorian.
Thank you.
So have you been gauging any of the reactions? It's been overwhelmingly positive, and it must be nice to trend on Twitter and not be canceled, actually be celebrated.
It's been weird. It has been a very strange day. I woke up this morning to, like, you know, many, many texts and emails about it. And I was sort of like, how did everybody watch it this early in the morning? Like, why is it like 7 in the morning in LA? So, you know, it was definitely unexpected, but it's a great thing. And I'm really happy for the show.
What are some of your favorite reactions? I know you put a lot of work into the detail of this episode, and there's a lot to think about and consider, but, you know, from either an emotional moment or just some fun bit of dialogue, is there anything people are reacting to that you're especially, like, you know, pumping your fist over?
I was really happy when we premiered it. We premiered it in LA, and so we got to sort of see them big screen, which is great, with some of the real fans. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of the real Mandalorian fans there. And, you know, for the big moment at the end when the Mandalorians come down and they're flying, that's actually, you know, it was obviously a big moment on screen in live action. And there was a huge response from the audience about that. And, you know, I think both myself and the visual effects Supervisor, we were both breathed a huge sigh of relief that, thank God, you know, that it felt like we'd done that moment justice.
Oh, that's good. I was there with my little girl, and we both loved that moment. It was
great. Yeah, I mean, I was happy to not have to invoke the ire of all those Mando fans to tell me that they did it wrong. So, you know, you feel the responsibility of trying to get that one right.
Yeah. I feel like every filmmaker who comes to Star Wars brings a bit of themselves. They personalize it in some way, even though they're playing in a much bigger sandbox. What did you feel you were personally able to bring to the Mandalorian story with this this installment so early in the series?
I think with this episode, you know, obviously the roots are in Westerns and Samurai, and you know, there's a pretty strong Yojimbo reference going on in the episode. For me, you know, it's obviously my dad, Chinese, and I had grown up, like, he was a huge movie fan, and he was, you know, so I grew up when he was watching Hong Kong action films and Chinese soaps the whole time. So to kind of get to reference, you know, I tried to bring a little bit of Hard Boiled with the baby, and to sort of get back to go back to Kurosawa, it was a really kind of amazing thing because it was almost like coming back to sort of classic cinema and filmmaking.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's definitely a lot of my dad, I think, in the episode.
Oh, that's nice. Is your dad still around? Is he,
No, he passed away sadly. So sadly, he didn't get to see this, but I know he'd be very proud if he did. He'd probably also be in shock.
Well, I'm very sorry to hear that, but, I know that, you know, as somebody who grew up with Star Wars, I know what it's like to share that, like, with a parent, and also to, as a dad now myself, I know, boy, if I heard my daughter speak about me that way years down the line and say that something I introduced her to became a part of her work, I just think that what a great loving tribute that is to him. So that's really sweet. Thanks for sharing that.
Well, I'm sure she will. She's going to be saying it one day.
So you put some of your dad's favorite Hong Kong action spirit into this episode. It really was an action-oriented installment. That battle at the end was intense. And did you have a particularly favorite moment that you got to craft and create?
I crafted, you know, it's like we worked on that, you know, because it's quite a long sequence. Cause it starts with all the stuff and, you know, getting the baby out of the compound. And I have to say, like, I really took a pretty strong shine to killing stormtroopers. I actually really loved doing that. so, you know, it was just sort of fun. So one of the challenges with the episode was to make the action interesting and very character-driven, but didn't just feel like, oh, we're just kind of, you know, flogging through this. So we were trying to, I was trying to really, you know, and obviously with John's script and with a lot of help from Filoni, is to craft it so that everything felt, you know, there's something different about each sequence, which I feel like we got mostly right, which is gratifying because we put a lot of work into trying to get that right.
Yeah. Yeah, played beautifully, and the tension just kept ratcheting up and up and up. And I wondered, you know, I spoke with Emily Swallow, who plays the Armorer, and she's also going to be on our podcast, and she spoke about, you know, you were blocked shooting, so she was shooting the pilot episode and this episode at kind of the same time. And I asked about working with you, and she said, oh, you know, I'm really glad I got to work with Deborah so early in the development of this character because I put a lot of her presence on set into the Armorer. And I wondered if she discussed that with you. That's what she said. Yeah. And she said, you have like this very, like, you have control of the room, but it's a very, like, it's a very calm control. And, well, anyway.
Oh, my God. she's never said, like, she never told me that. Wow. Okay.
Well, there you go.
But that's great. That's a huge compliment. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, also one of the things that helped achieve that is the fact that we did a lot of prep and we were in there for months before. So there was, you know, it was very designed. Like we didn't just show up on the day, that's for sure.
Right.
So I think all that prep sort of paid off into helping make the set feel that way. There was sort of a plan for everything.
That's good.
But she was awesome. She was great. And it's such a great character.
You're also the first woman to direct live action Star Wars. And I wondered if you had any thoughts on the significance of that.
It's strange. It is really weird. You know what I mean? Like, I grew up in Canada. I didn't have any connection to the business. So to sort of end up in this position is definitely not something I was ever expecting. And I really, even when I first got this job, it didn't even cross my mind. I mean, I don't know what fairyland I was into, but to not think that this was significant, but I literally wasn't even thinking about it, you know? So I sort of went through prep, and it didn't even really occur to me until somebody said it, I think, when on one of the first days I was shooting. Because, you know, obviously Bryce is directing as well, and, you know, the kids had done the second unit. So, it didn't occur to me that it would kind of be the first thing released. But it's an honor, you know, it's an amazing thing. So I'm really proud of it.
That's good. I mean, I wasn't sure if it was something you thought, like, should it be noted or should it just be considered not something that is made a big deal of, or I don't know. It seems important to me, and definitely the fans have been asking for broader representation in the filmmaking perspective. But you say you didn't really feel the weight of it until what, like until afterward or?
No, probably not until today, honestly.
Oh, really?
not really. I mean, you know, I think there's two sides to it, right? Like, I'm a director. So first and foremost, I want it to be about the work, you know, like I want to be a good director, not a good female director, but not a good Asian director. So it's about the work, I think, as a director, but on the same, you know, by the same token, you know, obviously, you know, my career path and just sort of the representation, it is important and it is meaningful, you know, that I want to see more women directors and want to see more directors of color. So, I think it is important, but at the same time, I hope it doesn't take away from the work or try to justify it in any way, you know?
Yeah, no, not at all. I mean, the people are applauding the episode just for its sheer entertainment value and its thrills and its heart. And I think, my feeling is it's a nice pioneering moment and something that everybody can look at and aspire to no matter who you are. I guess that's a nice after effect of doing good work, right?
Exactly. Well, that's kind of the point of it. I mean, for me, I think, both in terms of gender and race, it's like, ideally, we get to the point where it doesn't matter anymore. Mm-hmm. You know that we're all there and we're all on the same playing field, and it just does become about the work. Mm-hmm. You know?
Now, whenever somebody works on Star Wars, it all looks cool in the finished product, but there's like a kind of natural absurdity to making Star Wars because you're dealing with like robots and puppets and people in masks and people in fursuits and aliens and things that aren't even there because they'll be added as visual effects later.
Yes.
Did you ever feel that way? I mean, I remember Mark Hamill saying he wasn't so sure that Star Wars was going to work because it all seemed very cool, but he's running along and he's beside Sir Alec Guinness and a guy in a space monkey suit, and the monkey is the one who's going to fly them out of there. And like, he's like, I don't know if this is actually a good idea. Were there ever any moments where you were like, this is just
absolutely
bizarre?
Yeah, I mean, I had a day where I think it was one of the weirdest moments I've ever had directing, where I was directing Werner with the puppet, and you know, you have Mando, and Werner just had fallen in love with the baby, and Werner, I think, had forgotten that it wasn't actually a live creature and started sort of directing the baby. And then Werner's talking to the baby as though it's a real thing, and I'm trying to direct Werner, and I was just like, how did I get here? How did my life end up like this? Certainly I had days where I'm like, I'd have the Ugnaught and like other, you know, and Mando and a helmet and a puppet and this and a droid over in the corner, just like, oh my god, does anybody have eyes? Like, is there a human face anywhere? But it, that said, I mean, that's the amazing thing, you know, like, I love genre, like, I come from a fantasy and sci-fi background, like, that's what I genuinely love as a fan, so it's sort of a dream come true, so the weirder the better for me.
That sounds great. Tell me about Baby Yoda. I mean, there's a phenomenon around this being. People are obsessed with it. Like I said, my little girl, when we were watching the three episodes back to back, every time that thing would appear on screen, she would just grab me and be like, he's so cute, he's so cute. Like, and everybody on the planet seems to be doing that, including Werner Herzog. So
yeah.
So tell me about your experience with with Baby Yoda. And should we call it Baby Yoda? What should we actually, how do we refer to this thing?
Well, I will definitely defer to Dave Filoni on that. Okay. I think he said, I mean, you should check with the powers that be on this, but I think that he said it was acceptable because we haven't, you know, we haven't actually given it another name yet.
Right. So it's
standard. I think it's okay, but I don't know. I'm definitely not going to be the voice of authority on that question. I know that one's being very, very hotly contested.
But what's it like being around this thing? Is it always a puppet? Is it sometimes digital animation? What can you tell me about what it's like seeing it in real life?
It was pretty magical. I mean, it was a mixture. So it was puppetry and some visual effects. Mm-hmm. But the puppeteers were amazing. You know, they're the ones who, it was like working with an actor. You know what I mean? They're the ones who gave it humanity and gave it life. Mm-hmm. But it was pretty special, and you could feel it on set. You know, it's like when you have everybody from Werner Herzog to even like, you know, grips and gaffers getting moved by it. Like every time we brought it on set, everybody would just be sort of melting. Kind of, you know, it felt like, oh, I hope the audience feels the same way that we do.
Yeah.
But it was pretty magical, you know.
And you can actually direct it. You can ask for like certain emotions or expressions, and they can, you know, make that happen.
Yeah. I mean, I just worked with it, honestly. I worked with the puppeteers and with visual effects, and I just worked with it as though it was an actor, where it would just be about emotions. Like, I'm not going to try to tell them technically how to do it. That's right. Up for them to, you know, obviously manipulate. But I would just say, you know, it's like we would talk through it, and it would be like, okay, here's the scene. The door opens, and there's a scary thing. So, you know, he's going to shrink back. He feels scared right now. He's going to, you know, look to Mando for comfort. So it just sort of, we'd do it that way, where it was really just about following the emotional through line and then just let them all interpret it.
Oh, wow.
You know? Well, but really we just treated it like it was an actor.
Sorry to interrupt.
Oh, that's,
we have to wrap.
I'll wrap it up. That's it. I just want to say thank you so much for talking to me on your big day, and congratulations. You have another episode coming
down
the line, right? So you did two
episodes. Thank you. Yeah, another one coming, yeah.
Well, I can't wait to see that, and I know everybody knows you're working on the Obi-Wan series, so I hope that's going well.
Yeah.
And just wish you the best of luck.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, we did it. That's it for episode 3. We are in the dark with the rest of you as the Mando goes off on his next adventure with the baby in tow. Until next time, Anthony, where can people find your work?
You can find me on Twitter, at Bresnikan.
You can find both of us at vanityfair.com. You can find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This, and you can find me talking about The Crown, actually, which we referred to a little ways back in this feed in an earlier Still Watching episode, or talking about award season on the Little Gold Men podcast. And until next time, we'll see you in space.
Oh, but we have a new catchphrase. Don't we have a new sign off?
Oh yeah, you want to try it? Okay, well, let's do the new one. You should say
we have to give a shout out to the person who proposed it.
Okay.
I got a Twitter message from a listener named David Valadez, and he said, "Yo, Anthony, just finished your second episode of your podcast with Joanna. If it hasn't been suggested by some other fans yet, your sign off catchphrase should be, 'We have spoken.'"
All right, let's try to say it.
a little nod to Nick Nolte's Ugnaught character, Kuil. Thanks for providing insight on the show. Look forward to hearing more. Thank you, David, for this suggestion. I sent it to Joanna right away with a bunch of exclamation points, and we both loved it. So I think we have our sign off, right, Joanna?
All right. So until next time, we have spoken.
We have spoken.
All right, well,
wait, one more time. Okay. That's right. Well, one more time with that real Kuil,
right,
like almost like arrogant, liking your own Facebook post energy.
Great.
All right, ready?
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Until next time.
We have spoken.
Want to stay up to date on the biggest stories in pop culture and entertainment? Then be sure to check out the TMZ podcast. I'm Charlie Cotton from TMZ, the TV show, and every day I'll sit down with a member of our news team to give exclusive breakdowns of the day's most talked about headlines, stories we break, and the stories you care about. So check out the TMZ podcast, Monday through Friday, and the other podcasts from the TMZ Audio Network, like Last Days and TMZ Verified, available on all podcast platforms.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.